In a field or profession filled with countless unique and eccentric individuals, William Faulkner stands out as a true visionary storyteller, as controversial as he is talented. Whatever one's take on Faulkner, and there are many takes, positive and negative, to be had, the story of American letters cannot be told without his inclusion. His stretch of publishing from 1929 to 1937 is, to put it mildly, a miracle in fiction and novel writing. That period, which saw the publication of The Sound and the Fury, As I Lay Dying, Light in August, and Absalom, Absalom, found William Faulkner at the height of his imaginative powers. His status as a Southern chronicler and American modernist culminated in his reception of the Nobel Prize in 1949. However, does Faulkner still hold up today? Is he, as many would suggest, just too difficult to be worth reading? For many, As I Lay Dying represents the best entry point into Faulkner, a gateway, of sorts, into a world of beautiful language, epic journeys, and difficult themes. Still, the novel is far from easy. Few authors have delved as deeply and painfully into family life, asking questions such as, is love meaningful? Should a dead person's wishes be honored? What is grief? And is there humor in tragedy? We will explore all this, as well as Faulkner's legacy more broadly, today on the Thousand Lives podcast.
Hi there, and thank you so much for listening. I'm Ivan.
And I'm Troy.
And this is the Thousand Lives Podcast. The Thousand Lives Podcast is focused on exploring and discussing literature, from the age-old classics to contemporary works. We will be doing deep dives on the books that you know and love, as well as put books and authors in conversation with each other in what we hope will be fun and unique ways. Before we get started, we have a little bit of explaining to do, because as you see, our last episode came out in late October, and it is now May 11th, so definitely not an ideal release schedule, but I would be remiss if I didn't talk about why that is, and the truth is, we've had some life changes. Half of our show is now living in New York City. That's right, me. I'm living in New York City, and I haven't found the proper footing to record these regularly until now. And for that, I'd like to apologize both to the listener and to my co-host, Troy. I hope that with the summer coming right around the corner, Troy and I can bring you more episodes in a timely manner. So thank you for sticking with us during this time, and I hope that we can continue to make you, the listener, happy. With that being said, Troy, kick us off.
Okay, so Ivan, today we are delving into the life and mostly the work of one of the most notorious and powerful writers in American letters and American literature, and really, honestly, I would say world literature, and that is William Faulkner. Just for people who might not know quite as much about Faulkner, a little bit of a brief overview. William Faulkner was born in 1897 and died in 1962, which by today's standards isn't an especially long life, but in that period of time, he became easily one of the preeminent authors of the 20th century. So Faulkner, along with Joyce and Hemingway and Kafka and Toni Morrison and Gertrude Stein and McCarthy and Pynchon and Orwell and anyone else you want to mention, he's right up there in the upper echelon of American writers and world writers during the 20th century. Today we're focused on his book As I Lay Dying, which was published in 1930. I think that honestly he has four books that we could and might do episodes on at some point, but I think As I Lay Dying is a good one for us to start with because it's often considered kind of a really good gateway into Faulkner. It's a little bit easier than The Sound and the Fury or Absalom, Absalom, yet it shows you some of the reasons why people love Faulkner so much. What makes this book unique is it falls in line with the publication of his other masterpieces. So he publishes The Sound and the Fury, and then really quickly after that, he publishes As I Lay Dying, and then a couple years go by, and he cranks out two more masterworks, Light in August and Absalom, Absalom. And, you know, I was racking my brain trying to think of any other author that has published that many great works in such a short period of time. And I'm not sure I can come up with one since Shakespeare, to be honest. So
James Patterson, baby.
James Patterson. Yeah. I was going to mention someone else, but we're going to leave that be. Yeah, As I Lay Dying Anyway, it's right in the heart of his sort of prime, his writing prime. He is known as a writer for a couple different things. First of all, he's very much a regional writer. He's known as a Southern writer, and he writes about issues plaguing the South and honestly the decline of the South in a lot of ways. He's also really known for his stylistic experimentation. So when we think about modernism, that's sort of a loaded word, just like postmodernism, but there's one component of modernism which is very focused on style and stylistic experimentation, the kind that James Joyce was doing and Gertrude Stein was doing, and he is really in line with those two. So you often see stream of consciousness, you see experimentation with different characters' points of view, and we're going to talk more about that when we get into the book, but those are kind of the two main things that I think it's important to know about him as a person, is he was a Southern writer and he was an American modernist.
I've often heard the sentiment that As I Lay Dying, compared to the other three novels that he wrote in that period of time, is sort of like Faulkner light, which is to say it's an easier form of Faulkner's writing to read. Do you agree with that sentiment?
Probably. It's certainly easier than The Sound and the Fury. The Sound and the Fury is really, really challenging. You can see him working on some of the things that he would do later on in his career. So I would say it's an easier read than The Sound and the Fury for sure. Light in August is a difficult read because of some of the themes that it confronts and some of the ambiguities. I do think As I Lay Dying is the place to start for Faulkner because it's short. For example, it's significantly shorter than our last book that we did, My Brilliant Friend. And I think that it gives you the best of Faulkner without maybe some of the worst of Faulkner. So,
and I would say even though it's shorter than a book like My Brilliant Friend, it's definitely harder to read and it'll probably take you a lot longer. You probably have to reread it a couple times before you even begin to understand like kind of what's going on in the plot. I mean, I read the book 4 times, so now it's like I understand more of what's going on, but you know, when you first read it, you're like, what is happening right now? It's a challenging book for sure.
We've read it differently, right? Like you read it once and then a couple years passed and then you've read it 2 or 3 more times in short succession. And I've also read it 4 times, but with more space in between each reading, right? Am I right in that?
Yeah, that's right. And I think we're even reading it with different intentions as well. Like when you read it, I think that you're, you know, really delving deep into like the language, the structure, you know, all the sort of elements of a typical literary criticism. Whereas when I'm reading it, I'm not as concerned with that. I'm more concerned with like the social, political narratives and context of that time and just kind of seeing what we can learn from that. So I think even with that regard, we do read it differently. And before we go any further, we should give the listeners a general summary of the novel, and it goes something like this. As I Lay Dying traces the Bundren family, a cast of misfits comprising of visionaries, lunatics, bastards, and more, as they set out on a journey to bury their recently deceased mother in her hometown of Jefferson. Along the way, the family faces a set of seemingly impossible odds that test their wills and culminate a climactic and perhaps comical conclusion.
Yeah, I think you hit the main points right, and we'll get more into this. I want to talk just briefly about where this book falls in the kind of literary tradition that came before it. It's definitely a quest narrative or a journey narrative in the traditional sense. The title, As I Lay Dying, actually comes from the Odyssey, Homer's The Odyssey, which is also a quest narrative. And you can see influences of Moby Dick in this book. Faulkner has praised Moby Dick and Herman Melville in the past. And you can see this book's influence on a book like Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. I think Harold Bloom called Moby Dick, As I Lay Dying, and Blood Meridian American prose epics, and I think that's a really good way of thinking about them. They're quest narratives. They are journey narratives, and this is a unique one for sure, and I'm sure we'll get to the other two at some point.
I think it might be worthwhile to mention as well that in The Odyssey, the journey takes 10 years, and in As I Lay Dying, the journey takes 10 days, so there's a little bit of a call to that as well.
Yeah, and that's always really interesting to me is like how authors choose to deal with time, right? I mean, I think about Ulysses, which everything in that book takes place in the course of kind of a day. So that book is also heavily influenced by the Odyssey. So I think you have some of the major authors at the time, Faulkner and Joyce, looking at the Odyssey and thinking, hey, how can we rewrite this quest narrative, which is an inherent part of human being storytelling, and do it in unique ways or compressed ways? The way that we're going to go about this book, it's always kind of a question that we toss around. Like, do we go plot summary style or do we focus on characters? I think we're going to do this book similarly to how we did My Brilliant Friend, which is we're going to discuss characters and their motivations. And through those discussions, we're going to have ample opportunities to look at themes, plot points, and literary devices. But this book has so many different characters to discuss, we're trying to pair them up in strategic ways. So the first pair of characters that I think we're going to focus on will be Ants and Addie. This is husband and wife, father and mother. Ants is the husband and father. Addie is the wife and mother. And their sort of dynamic, even though she's dead, really drives the book and the plot forward. So I guess I would just start by saying, when I think about Ants and Addie, I think about the tension between words and actions, right? Addie actually narrates a section of this book, and one of the more salient points that come out of that, or that comes out of that section, is Addie has decided that for her and her life, based on her experiences, language is meaningless, and that words really don't have any power other than the power that has been imbued by people looking to fill a space or a void in their lives. So when we think about the word love, for example, to her, saying I love you or love doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have any significance unless it is also supported by action. Marriage is another word that doesn't mean anything. It was just arbitrarily assigned to something, and it takes action to give the word meaning. Ants, her husband, on the other hand, is very much a man of words, but not really a man of action. Honestly, Ants is just not that great of a guy. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's a mild way to describe it for sure. Yeah, I agree with that.
Selfish, lazy, sloth, greedy. Slothful. He's very much sloppy, a slob. He's sloth.
A bum.
He's just not a good guy, but he puts a lot of meaning on words. He always seems to kind of have the right thing to say. Like after his wife has passed away, he repeats the phrase, I don't begrudge her it, over and over and over in the book. But he doesn't have any action. So he'll say things like, oh, I loved Addie, or I love my wife, I didn't begrudge her. But you can tell based on her representation of their relationship that it was a loveless marriage. It wasn't backed up by any kind of actions. So those two characters, Addie and Ants, are kind of in a cycle where she values action and not words, and he values words without action, and they resent each other for it, and then the rest of the family members feel that resentment. So when we think about themes in the book, I would definitely say words versus action is a theme, and it can apply to other characters too. I think we might touch on this a little bit with Darl and Jewel. Some people think things through and talk things through, and then others take action, and the book sort of leaves it up to you, I would say, to decide if words have meaning, if actions have meaning, if it takes both, or kind of where you fall on that spectrum. What do you think about this? Like, do words matter if they're not accompanied by action? Do you side with Addie? Do you side with Ants?
I think I've shared this with you in a different conversation, but I tend to be more sympathetic towards Addie. I think that she's gotten the raw end of the deal when it came to marrying Ants. Like you said, you know, Ants is definitely a man of words and not actions. And I think that Addie, you know, she sort of gets used by Ants to do his work, you know, cook, clean, stuff like that. The resentment is definitely palpable with Addie. Yeah. And I think that she has a very bleak worldview. And this worldview causes her to punish others based on how she's feeling. You can see this with the way that she teaches school children and just her general feelings towards children in general. Yeah, I think she's more sympathetic, though.
Yeah, and I do want to point out, I definitely think that you have a more positive look on Addie. It could be because I'm a teacher myself, and so her sort of views on children rub me the wrong way. But Ants is not a good guy. I would say she's not a great person, and their sort of dynamic and individual troubles and combined troubles make for a dysfunctional family. And really, that's at the heart of the narrative. I mean, nobody wants to read a novel of any page length about a family that is all sunshines and roses and really gets along well and communicates, you know, emotionally or with emotional maturity. The family's dysfunctional, and I think that their own separate dysfunctionalities combined together is the root cause of that.
Do you think there are, like in the books that you've read, would you say that this is the most dysfunctional family that you've read of?
Probably. It's, I'm trying to just kind of rack my brains. I'm picturing my bookshelf in my mind. I think what Faulkner does really well is he creates a family with super distinct characters. I mean, I think the book has something like 15 different narrators, but when you just focus on the Bundren family, you have Ants, Addie, Jewel, Darl, Cash, Vardaman, and Dewey Dell. And in just a short number of pages, he really fleshes out those characters in their motivations in a lot of detail. So I'm not sure they're the most dysfunctional. I'll keep thinking about it, but they're definitely one of the best depicted, for sure.
The only other family that I think it might be more dysfunctional would be in the Moon Down to Earth, just the relationship between Elizabeth and her mother. I think that's probably, to me, more dysfunctional. And I know we'll discuss this further, but one of the interesting things that I just thought of was when you mentioned that Ants is sort of like a man of words, I think of that, of Darl, who's like, you know, Ants doesn't have like the most unique dictionary, you know, but Darl definitely does. His seed, right? His son is definitely much more well-versed than Ants is. So it's kind of interesting to think about that personification of Darl from Ants' characteristics.
Yes. I think it's interesting, too, because you talk about Elizabeth and her mother and Moon Down to Earth, but I think what would separate the Bundren family from them and makes them more memorable to me is there's more of them, and I think their motivations are a little bit harder sometimes to determine. Like, Dewey Dell is a character I think we pretty clearly see, and we'll talk about her later as well, what she's going after and what she wants. But then, you know, like, Vardaman, he's a little bit tough to read. Cash is tough to read. So there's more ambiguity in the family, I would say. I'm thinking also about Beloved, Setha, Denver, Beloved, Paul D. That's kind of a crazy family dynamic. I'm thinking about Raskolnikov and his family in Crime and Punishment. I'm thinking about Renthy and Culla in Outer Dark by Cormac McCarthy.
That's actually another, I forgot about that one. That's another one too. That's very, very dysfunctional.
So do you want to compare and contrast them with Tull and Korra a little bit and just give some info on them?
Yeah, so to start off, Tull and Korra so his name is Vernon Tull and Korra Tull. They're their neighbors, would you say?
Yeah.
The neighbors are pretty much like the more successful version of this marriage, so they're very pious. Korra's more pious than Tull is on paper, mm-hmm. but you know, for Tull, sure. he's more of a helping hand, right? Like he sees sort of like the dysfunction going on in the Bundren family and, you know, tries to help out whenever he can. He's a good Christian in that sense, so one of the things he does is like he hires the Bundren boys to do different odd jobs. And Korra, you know, on paper, she's sympathetic towards the Bundren family, but, you know, kind of like in her own personal feelings of them, she's very critical. And sometimes actually she's very vocal about how critical she is. She'll persistently tell her husband like, oh, they're not doing X and Y right. She's very much like a prototypical like judgmental Christian. I don't want to say like in such a disparaging way towards Christians, but like she's very judgy, sometimes hypocritical. She does the it's my way or the highway sort of thing. And it generally, mm-hmm. to me, seems like she's not genuinely interested in helping the Bundrens. She is more so keen on judging them. If you compare, for example, like the seven deadly sins for each of these characters, Korra would be something akin to like pride. And then Ants, on the other hand, would be something like sloth. So I think perhaps Korra is the most unlikable character in the book for me, but it's mainly just due to the fact that she's more words than actions, in my opinion. And she really is judgmental, so that's probably why I would characterize her as the worst character in the book.
She's around when Addie's dying, though, right? I mean, she's there a little bit for that, but I see what you're saying. There's something hypocritical about her in the sense that she wants to love Jesus and God more than anything, and she definitely thinks that Ants and Addie fall short of Christian sort of benchmarks, but then through her judgment and kind of gossip, she herself is also falling short of the standards that she's trying to hold them to. So it's kind of a traditional Christian or maybe just even religious person predicament where you have these standards that you think people should meet, yet nobody can really do that. So who are you to judge? But yet she does judge. One of the things that Korra gets really frustrated with, right? Correct me if you had a different interpretation. She's upset because she sees that Addie has a certain type of reverence for her son, Jewel, that not only does she not have for the other two kids, Cash and Darl, who I don't know. I think you could argue that Jewel's the worst of the three boys, but we can talk about them later. But Addie has a special connection with Jewel that she doesn't have with her other kids. And to Addie, Jewel is almost like a Christ-like figure. She says that he's going to save her through flood and fire, and he actually does end up doing that. But Cora thinks that she needs to be worshiping God a little more and Jewel a little less.
Yeah, I definitely read it the same way, and I think it's interesting to point out how Addie responds to some of the criticisms of Cora. Addie has one chapter in the book, and you know, her criticism of Cora is like, hey, who are you to judge me? Like, you're not even a good mom. You can't even cook. Like, she, again, her response is about the things that Cora can and can't do, whereas Cora's criticisms of Addie are, here's what you're doing wrong, you know, but it's just words.
Yeah, well, I think you hit on it earlier. Addie doesn't like people who are all about words, so she doesn't like her husband, but I think Cora also falls into that for her. I think she's like, oh, this is just a talker. This is someone who is performative, and she doesn't really get it, what it's like in the real world. Addie's much more jaded, where I would say Cora tries to maintain a more innocent or pure view of things, even if it is naive. Their dynamic is interesting. Telling Cora, there's a lot into them. I was watching a lecture on this book, and the professor, it's through Yale Open Courses. I don't really want to say too much because I can't. I'm not sure I would do her argument justice, but you can check it out. She was talking about how Cora and Tull represent sort of like the economics of the book, because Cora is very preoccupied with like selling these baked goods and the eggs and everything. So they're, for minor characters, and I'm doing air quotes right now, they're actually pretty significant. And I think that's one of Faulkner's strengths, is like every person who appears on the page serves some kind of a role. Anything else you want to say about Ants and Addie or Tull and Cora, or should we get into the heart of the book, which is Darl, Cash, and Jewel?
No, more things will be revealed about them later on, so let's go ahead and move on to the trio.
Okay, so we have, I was going to say three brothers. We actually have four brothers. Vardaman is much younger. We've paired Cash, Jewel, and Darl together because I think that the way that they all handle their mother's death not only reveals a lot about them, I think it moves the plot forward. So we're going to talk about each one individually. I would just say that Cash is probably the most dedicated to her. No, that's not true. I want to say Cash is the most stoic and kind of reverts into himself and shows his dedication through action and craftsmanship. Jewel is also very much about action. However, he's much more cold. He doesn't talk very much. He's aggressive. He's angry. And then you have Darl. Darl's kind of a bit of a visionary. I would say he's sort of a Faulkner surrogate in the novel. But yeah, the way that those three brothers deal with their mother's death, I think, speaks to one of the themes in the novel, which is methods of coping with grief and death. What do you think? Should we start with Darl?
Yeah.
Okay. So Darl is a really interesting character to me. He's probably one of my favorite characters in American fiction.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Troy's a Darl Glazer for sure. He told me.
Okay. I'm a Darl fan. Let's put it that way. Anyway, Darl is, I call him a visionary. I think Harold Bloom also called him a visionary. He certainly has powers of sight or knowledge that seem somewhat superhuman, right? It's important to know that when the book starts, Addie is not dead yet, but it's clear, right, Ivan, that she's dying. She's close.
Right, she's in the house pretty much on her deathbed.
Right, she's in the house, she's dying. She literally is laying dying, as the title would suggest. Her son Cash is outside building her coffin. Jewel and Darl get called away on a job. Probably not the right time for them to leave, right?
Couldn't pass up the money. Couldn't pass up those $2.
According to them, but also doesn't Ants pretty much push that?
He kind of has his foot in the water, like he could go either way.
But he's also greedy. He's also greedy, and he's like,
yeah, he needs the money for the teeth, so he's not passing up the $2.
And we'll get to the teeth later on. Anyway, we get Darl and Jewel who leave, and as they're coming back, Addie dies. So Addie dies when Darl and Jewel are gone from the house. Yet somehow Darl seems to know this, right?
Right. They're riding on this wagon, and he has this little vision, and he turns around and tells Jewel, like, hey, your mom's dead.
She's dead. She's dead, Jewel. She's dead. I'm trying to find the exact part. He's sort of teasing him a little bit. He's like, your horse is okay, though, but mom's dead. So Darl has knowledge that it seems like he shouldn't have. He knows things about Dewey Dell, that it seems like he shouldn't know, and she resents him for that. And I think all the characters resent him. There's definitely a sense that he's kind of an outcast, not only in the family, but also in the town. Cora and Tull speak about him. There's just something a little bit off about him, would you say?
Yeah, they call him like the queer boy. They call him...
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, there's something off for sure.
He doesn't fit in, and he really doesn't fit in terms of the writing style. He narrates the most sections of anyone in the book. So most of the sections of the book are from his perspective rather than Jewel or Ants or Vardaman. And he really feels like the most traditional narrator. And I think that his heightened intelligence is important because he becomes kind of a stand-in for Faulkner. So Faulkner unleashes some of his most beautiful prose in Darl's passages, right? Like, Vardaman is a much younger child, so Faulkner has to limit himself a little bit in the way that he's writing when he's writing from Vardaman's point of view, because a child just wouldn't have that kind of language. But if we're to believe that Darl is kind of a genius and a visionary, then he can speak in ways that are more flamboyant and beautiful and sublime, and that's exactly what we see. He's a threat to the people around him, and it fosters animosity in his direction. He uses his knowledge, and he weaponizes it, and he taunts people for it. And eventually, he descends into madness. And at the end of the book, the family turns him in and claims that he's insane. So he gets taken away from his family and sent to what we can kind of presume is sort of a mental hospital or an asylum. Yeah, what do you make of that? Do you think he's mad?
I think he's always been mad, and I think maybe some of the clairvoyance that he has can be kind of just summed up to that. And I know that's not probably like what you want to hear, but I think that's just kind of like what it seems like. You know, like you mentioned, he has some of the most eloquent language in the book, and like you also mentioned, he's a stand-in for Faulkner. So towards the end of the book, when the twist is that he's mad, right? So it's a shocking twist, and I think that it makes you question whether or not he was just crazy the entire time.
I don't know. I'm not sure, because it's like he knows things he shouldn't know, but does that make a person mad, or does it make them superhuman? Does it make them highly intelligent? The action that leads his family to commit him is the family is getting close to the end of the novel, or the novel is getting close to the end. The family is getting close to Jefferson, where Addie wants to be buried. I think it's been, you know, something like 9 days, and they're staying. This family is gracious enough to kind of let them stay on the property, and they're staying in a barn, but everybody listening can imagine or knows what would happen to a body after 9 days in the southern heat, right? She stinks. She reeks. And everywhere they go, buzzards follow them. I think the buzzards become kind of a symbol. So his mother, Darl's mother, Addie's corpse is rotting in the coffin. Yet the family, and Ants in particular, is hell-bent on getting her to Jefferson. Darl eventually decides that he's just going to light the barn on fire. So in the middle of the night, he lights that man's barn on fire in an attempt to burn his mother's corpse, and I guess in a way kind of cremate her, right? Like, he wants to put the journey to an end. Is that an act of hatred, or do you think that that's an act of love towards her? How do you read that?
I think it's more an act of love. That's how I read it. It was more of a, let's just kind of put her out of her misery, right? Like, she's already suffered enough. It's like, it's not only has she sort of been embarrassed throughout her life, now we're also embarrassing her after she's already dead and her body's just decaying. That's how I read it. It's almost like, let's put this person to rest already. Let's just get it over with, instead of, you know, going on this crazy journey to Jefferson, which is 40 miles away and takes 10 days to get there.
She's been something. I mean, she's been pretty much brutalized. Her corpse has been brutalized. After she dies, she's in a coffin that Cash has made for her, and we'll talk more about Cash and the coffin in a minute. But her youngest son, Vardaman, thinks she's still alive, so he drills holes into the coffin, and he drills holes right through her face to try to let her breathe, not understanding that she's dead. The coffin has been sunk in the water through a flood. It's been 9 days. Her body is rotting. Buzzards are circling overhead. And so, yeah, I'm with you. I think that Darl tries to burn it to kind of put everyone out of their misery. I mean, this journey has taken a toll on not only Addie's corpse, but everyone. Cash has been brutalized. Jules lost his horse.
Yeah, and I think that each character, with the exception of Darl, sort of has like their own individual motivations and agenda that sometimes outweighs the primary goal of getting Addie buried in Jefferson. Like, I do think that secretly Darl is the only person that does want to get the situation over with. Every other character wants to see it through because they know that what lies ahead in Jefferson is something that they want. For example, Vardaman, who's very simple, wants bananas. Dewey Dow herself wants abortion medication, or what she thinks is something that will end her pregnancy. Cash also wants like a sound machine. I can't remember exactly what it was called. I think a gramophone or something like that. But they all have these little motivations for why they need to get to Jefferson as well.
I think you could argue that Darl and Jewel have the most pure intentions going with the mom, because like you said, Ants, Cash, Dewey Dell, Vardaman, everybody else has something kind of else in it for them. Those two seem to me the most focused on her, but again, they are at opposite ends of the spectrum. Jewel is very much a man of action. He doesn't talk. He's aggressive. He's uptight. He's action, action, action. When Darl tries to burn the barn, Jewel's the one who rushes through and saves her from the fire, which makes Addie's prediction about him come true. Darl is very much a man of words and thought and introspection. So Jewel's power is kind of his ability to do things and make things happen, whereas Darl's power is his intellect, and they're clashing throughout the novel. Just talk a little bit about how Darl ends the book. In the final scene, we see him in something like a disassociative state. He's riding in a train, and he's almost kind of looking on himself, riding the train to Jackson, and he's speaking about himself in kind of conditional language, but layers of conditional language, like, if I was, were, then I was, is, was. And it's honestly, it's really hard to understand what's happening to him, other than to say it seems like he's kind of left his body. I think that final scene when he kind of gets wrestled to the ground, right? Like,
yeah, by like four people, yeah,
including Dewey Dow and everybody. And he looks up at Cash, and I want to get the wording right on this because this is tragic to me.
While Troy looks for that passage, I'll talk about something else that's related. One of the themes that Troy brought up earlier with relation to Darl is the feeling of being an outcast, and I think that this is a feeling that's generally true of the entire family. They are all sort of outcasts in their own way. I would disagree with Troy when he said that Darl is the biggest outcast. I actually think Jewel is the biggest outcast, because not only is Jewel an outcast in society, just due to his socioeconomic status and everything else, you know, even being related to the Bundren family, but he's not even, he's not even accepted by his own family. He's sort of the black sheep, right? So, we'll talk about Jewel a little bit later, but that feeling of being an outcast is one of the shared themes among the Bundren family. Another one of the shared themes that relates specifically to Darl, Jewel, and Cash is this religious imagery and almost Christ-like characteristics that each of the boys exhibit. Looking at Darl specifically, one of the most well-known Christian stories is of Jesus at the Last Supper, where he has a premonition that someone at the table is going to betray him. And that someone, of course, being Judas, famously. Troy spoke earlier about the visions and premonitions that Darl has. It's almost like this ability to see what is happening, even when he's not there. Darl, just like Jesus Christ, also gets betrayed by a member of his family. That member, of course, being his sister, Dewey Dell, who tells everyone that Darl has set the barn on fire that is holding his mother's corpse. And that ultimately leads to his demise, obviously being sent to the insane asylum for his actions. His clairvoyance and, you know, being betrayed are two of the character traits that are most reminiscent of Jesus Christ. And it looks like Troy's just finished finding his passage, so he's going to read it now, which of course is the tragic scene of betrayal when Darl gets sent away.
And this is Cash narrating, and I like Cash as a narrator. Darl's my favorite, but I do like Cash. He says, "But the curiousest thing was Dewey Dell. It surprised me. I see all the while how folks could say he was queer, but that was the very reason couldn't nobody hold it personal. It was like he was outside of it, too. same as you. And getting mad at it would be kind of like getting mad at a mud puddle that splashed you when you stepped in it. And then I always kind of had an idea that him and Dewey Dell kind of knowed things betwixt them. If I'd have said it was Era one of us she liked better than Era another, I'd have said it was Darl. But when we got it filled and covered and drove out the gate and turned into a lane where them fellows was waiting, when they come out and come on him and he jerked back, it was Dewey Dell that was on him before even Jewel could get at him. And then I believed I'd knowed how Gillespie knew... note about how his barn taken fire. She hadn't said a word, hadn't even looked at him, but when them fellows told him what they wanted and that they had come to get him and he throwed back, she jumped on him like a wild cat so that one of the fellows had to quit and hold her and her scratching and clawing at him like a wild cat while the other one and Pa and Jewel throwed Darl down and held him lying on his back looking up at me. I thought you would have told me, he said. I never thought you wouldn't have. Darl, I said, but he fought again. Him and Jewel and the fellow and the other one holding Dewey Dell and Vardaman yelling and Jewel saying, kill him, kill the son of a bitch. It was bad so. It was bad. A fellow can't get away from a shoddy job. He can't do it. I tried to tell him, but he just said, I thought you'd have told me. It's not that I, he said. Then he began to laugh. The other fellow pulled Jewel off of him, and he sat there on the ground laughing. I tried to tell him, if I could have just moved and even set up, but I tried to tell him, and he quit laughing, looking up at me. Do you want me to go? He said. It'll be better for you, I said. Down there it'll be quiet, with none of the bothering and such. It'll be better for you, Darl. Better, he said. He begun to laugh again. Better, he said. He couldn't hardly say it for laughing. He sat on the ground and us watching him, laughing and laughing. It was bad. It was bad so. I'd be darned if I could see anything to laugh at. But there just ain't nothing justifies the deliberate destruction of what a man has built with his own sweat and stored with the fruit of his sweat into. But I ain't so sure that every man has a right to say what is crazy and what ain't. It's like there was a fellow in every man that's done a past the sanity or the insanity that watches the sane and insane doings of the man with the same horror and same astonishment. I don't know. To me, that's a really sad scene when he looks up and he says, I thought you would have told me. Because Cash is kind of, I don't know, Cash is like maybe the best guy in the book. I mean, he seems like he's got a really good head on his shoulders. He seems like he's pretty kind and hardworking. And for Darl to look up at him and say, man, I thought you'd let me know. It's Julius Caesar-ish. It's like Christ a little bit.
Right. And I think that Cash, is that after Cash is doing the whole like, oh, he's not so crazy after all. Like who could even call him crazy?
Well, that's right at the end. That's right at the end where he says, hey, well, I wonder sometimes who's a man to judge whether another man's sane or not, which is kind of the question that we were just debating.
Yeah, it's a very tragic scene. I think, it's all the more reminiscent of kind of like what happens to Christ in the Bible.
It's really, really reminiscent of the end of a book called We the Animals, which I'll talk about later on. Also about three brothers. One of them gets taken away to an insane asylum at the end as his brothers watch on as they kind of get held down. When I read this again, I thought there was no way Justin Torres hadn't read this book and internalized it.
And then I think that also speaks to how much Faulkner has just influenced authors after him. And, you know, as you've already talked about, like McCarthy, that's one of them. But yeah, Justin Torres for sure. And going back a little bit to the discussion about Darl being crazy, one of the elements that makes the story even more tragic is the fact that if you think about when the book was written, which was, you know, in the 1920s or so, there wasn't really that much literature about mental health. There wasn't really, and when I mean literature, I mean like scientific literature. It probably is the case that they didn't really know how to deal with, you know, the psychiatric disorder that Darl's dealing with. So the fact that they even sent him to the insane asylum and God knows what happens to him afterwards, you know, it even adds a little bit more to the story, just how sad the ending is.
I'm sure somebody's done an article or something about what he might have. I mean, does he have multiple personalities? Does he have schizophrenia? Somebody's done something on that. Should we move on? We've spent quite a bit of time on Darl. Should we move on to Jewel?
Yes, another outcast. And like I said before, I think that Jewel is the biggest outcast of the bunch because not only is he an outcast of society, like the rest of his family, but he's also the black sheep of the family. And a big part of why Jewel is the black sheep of the family is simply because he's just not like the others. He's not from the same cloth. None of the other members of the family besides Darl know this, but Jewel is actually the product of an extramarital affair between the town preacher, whose name is Whitfield, and his mother, Addie. Whitfield actually kind of has a funny and ridiculous chapter in this book where he has this call to action moment from God who wants him to go and confess his affair with Addie to her family as she's on her deathbed. And at first he tries to cross the bridge leading to their house that is pretty much underwater now. And he thinks that God is showing him mercy by putting this bridge underwater. But then he's able to cross the bridge and get to the Bundren home, or near it. Once he gets near the Bundren home, one of the neighbors comes out and tells the preacher that he is basically too late, that Addie has already passed away. And, you know, he kind of falls to his knees and says, "Oh, thank you, God. Thank you for basically like letting her die, because now I don't have to confess my sins to her or to her family anymore." So, you know, I think it's pretty clear from the book that he had no intention of actually going and apologizing and confessing his sins. But, you know, he was kind of just looking for any excuse to do it. Of course, I think it would have been inappropriate for him to even try to confess those sins to the family as Addie's on her literal deathbed. But it seems to me that he just needed his conscience clear, and making the journey to the house was apparently enough for him. So going back to Jewel again, like Troy already discussed previously, he is the rebellious type. He has a chip on his shoulder and he plays fairly fast and loose with things. But one of the Christ-like features that he has is that he is birthed by another man. And, you know, if you look back at the Bible, Jesus is birthed by God, not by Joseph. And Jewel is birthed by an ordained reverend who is essentially an extension of God himself. So on the one hand, you know, Jewel is the manifestation of Addie's sins and of Addie's resentment because, you know, Addie cheated on Anse with this reverend. But his personality is also a reflection of those feelings of Addie's stubbornness and resentment. On the other hand, on a spiritual level, if we use the, you know, the Christian model, Addie would be a Mary-like figure that is carrying the literal child of God.
Yeah, and a lot of that I would not have thought about. Just the idea that, like, because he is the product of a reverend, he's like, he really is a child of God in a unique way. Darl and Jewel are set against each other from the beginning. The opening of the book is really cool. You see them sort of walking up the road, and, you know, Jewel's head, he stands a full head up above him, so there's some physical differences immediately between them. And then, like we've talked about, there are very much differences in the way that they approach life. Darl is about cognition and intellect and thought and words, and Jewel is about action and aggression and making things happen. He sort of wills things into existence, which, you know, if you're like me and you tend to view Darl as, you know, a hero, if you line yourself with Darl, then it's easy to see Jewel as a villain. But this read through, I felt like he had more good traits than I had given him credit for. I mean, if his point of view is simply that the best thing he can do for his mom is to fulfill her dying wish and get her to Jefferson, then his act of running into the burning building is really nothing short of heroic. So how do you assess Jewel? Do you see him as good guy, bad guy, just in the middle? Do you view him positively, negatively?
During my second read through, I think you and I had a conversation about it, and I think that at that time I told you that I viewed Darl more negatively than I did Jewel. But then as I read through, I kind of view him as a little bit of like the anti-hero in the book, which is it's tough to say whether or not he's more good or more bad. I think his stubbornness can often lead the family to harm if you sort of trace the actions of his decisions. Cash directly gets harmed by this, right? By some of his thoughts. So in that sense, I think that his stubbornness really just does come out in some of the worst moments. And it's I don't know, it's hard because each character, I mean, truly each character really it can be the villain in separate parts of the book.
Maybe, and except Vardaman.
Yeah, I mean, well, Vardaman's what, like, he's like 8 years old, right?
Yeah.
I think in the book.
Right. But everybody else is really pretty complicated. I would say Vardaman's kind of a sympathetic figure. But everybody else is like, okay, positive, but kind of negative. Except, I don't know that Ants has a whole lot of positive to him. But yeah, your point is well taken.
Where would you rank them? Like, if you had to put them in a tier list and, you know, by most good and then most bad, where would you put them?
I think of the brothers, setting Vardaman aside, I think Cash is the best guy.
Interesting.
Darryl's second best, and Jules the worst. Because Cash, who we're going to get to, I mean, I have a note right here. I'm looking at our notes. Maybe this is a good kind of segue into Cash. I have probably underlined in bold the most likable character. He is very dedicated to his mom. He starts the novel building this coffin, and Faulkner takes a lot of care to let us know that Cash is taking a lot of care, right? He's not just slapping some coffin together. He is an expert carpenter who's putting all of his powers into this in one kind of maybe last act to his mom. But also, I think it could be symbolic of Faulkner's view of writing. I think that the kind of care that Cash puts into the coffin might speak to the way that Faulkner feels about writing. He is very stoic, right? At one point, he's broken his leg at work, and the leg is healed, but not great, right? It's the 1920s. And then
they put, like, cement over it or something ridiculous. Like, well, they literally just put, like a makeshift cast over it.
Well, yeah, that's later on. That's the second break, right? He breaks it again. He's in a lot of pain.
Close to death. Close to dying.
Close to dying, but he's still traveling on to Jefferson to help his mom get there. He's rattling around in the cart, which is going to hurt his leg. And then they decide to case it in cement, which is like the worst thing they could have done for it. And that's Ants' dumb decision again. And the doctor tells Ants at the end, why in the world did you do this? Now we're going to have to break this off. And that's painful. He's the least emotional, but I feel like he's kind of a baseline. He just seemed very, like, straight and narrow to me. He's straightforward. He wants to do his best. He's willing to suffer a lot of pain, which I think you're going to talk about how that makes him a little bit of a Christ-like figure. He takes a lot of bodily damage along the way. So to me, he's the most likable because he's the least problematic. I like Darryl because I think that his gesture in the end is a sacrifice, and I like his intellect. But, you know, he is taunting Jewel about his mother dying. He is sort of tongue-in-cheek with Dewey Dell's situation, so he's a little bit bitter there. And then to me, Jewel is not a bad guy, but he's just one of those guys that's like, I'm the lone wolf of the group, and he distances himself from everybody else. And so, like, we get more indication that Darryl is outcasted by society than Jewel, yet Jewel seems to isolate himself.
One of the things I do want to ask you now that we're talking about Cash is something that I notice is that it's pretty apparent, actually, that Cash just doesn't have a lot of chapters in the book. I think he, two or three, maybe?
I don't know, but it is interesting that he gets the chapter when Darryl's taken away.
Yeah, and I think even just, like, looking through the chapters, I think Dewey Dell even has more chapters than he does.
Jewel doesn't have very many. Jewel does not. And I think a part of it is, like, these are the two characters that are the least verbal or verbose. Like, Cash is a man of action. He builds his coffin. He does his work. He suffers his pain in silence. Jewel is a man of action. He's aggressive. He rides his horse. So I think, just practically speaking, they're not the best narrators for him because they don't speak.
I think even so, I think Cash still has less.
Yeah. So why do you think then that Faulkner gives Cash narration of the scene in which Darryl is taken away? Why give that one to Cash when you're right? He's not given that many.
I almost kind of think that's like the next in line of succession. You know, I think that if you look at each individual character who has like the most intellect, I think that Cash does have pretty good intellect. He just doesn't use his words very much. I mean, you know that he's extremely smart. He's able to describe actually in great detail how to build a coffin. You know, he talks about, like, you know, perfectly aligning the edges. Even I think he talks about, like, the materials he used. Yeah. I mean, Cash isn't, I personally think that Cash is kind of dumb, but he's not really dumb. Like, I think he's dumb in the sense that he's mute more than anything. So I think that that's probably why I didn't have such a initially strong perspective of him. But going further on that, I mean, I just don't think that Cash is, he's pretty smart. I think that's just, like, I think if anything, he's actually smarter than Jewel too. Jewel kind of, he's quick to get himself in debt. He's quick to make mistakes. Doesn't really, like you said, he's a man of action, but I think that he persistently doesn't think before he acts. And so Jewel's actions in and of himself kind of bring harm to the family, whereas Cash is a lot more calculated, and we can see it through his skill in carpentry.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think I probably agree with that. I don't think he's dumb by any stretch of the imagination. I think that Cash is kind of, because he feels a little neutral to me. I'm just thinking this through for the first time. I think that, like, why was Cash given the scene when Darl's taken away? And why have we not seen much of him before? I think if we had had 15 different Cash sections before, we would sort of know his sort of way of thinking better, and that would make him seem less objective and less neutral. I think by limiting the amount we get about Cash from his point of view early on, it makes us more inclined to kind of trust him as a neutral observer of what's happening, because physically Cash does not participate in the sort of takedown of Darl, because he can't. His legs hurt. So he's literally physically and mentally kind of off to the side watching. But yeah, he's a kind of emotional baseline to me, and I think that as such, it allows him to report the facts of what's happening to Darl.
I mean, who else could have been that person to deliver the chapter? I mean, maybe you could make the case for somebody like Dewey Dell.
She's too aggressive, she kinda, though.
Yeah, exactly. She's probably the least, you know, the least centered on it. I mean, she physically attacked Darl at the end, so.
Right. Couldn't be Jewel. Ance, I think, is he's too goofy. I think it would, you know, I mean,
Well, I mean, I think if it was Ance, and you also sacrifice the ending, because how his storyline sort of ends. So if you gave him the final word, then it's kind of, you know, sacrificing the ultimate reveal at the end.
Yeah, Cash was a natural narrator. Anything else to say about the brothers?
Yeah, the last thing I was going to talk about is just about the Christ-like characteristics of Cash, and they're a little bit more apparent here. So everyone knows that Jesus was a carpenter, and it should be no surprise now, Cash is also a carpenter. So there's that connection. And we talked about at the end of the book where Cash basically gives the last chapter, and he says basically like, maybe Darl wasn't so crazy after all for what he did to the barn and what he tried to do to his mother's corpse, which is set it on fire in the barn. The whole thing kind of gave me like the "let he who is without sin cast the first stone" vibes. And basically saying like, don't judge Darl for his actions, because maybe he's the most sane one of all here.
Yep, I think that's exactly right. And I just think the bodily damage too is really reminiscent.
It's so, yeah, you almost kind of forget, like as you're reading the book, you almost kind of forget Addie in certain instances. And then As the story progresses, when they're going to like the individual towns, people are like, "Yo, what are you guys carrying around?" Like, this is like, it's shocking to the senses. Like, you can only imagine like if somebody was parading around a dead body in the town that you live in. You know, it's flat out just offensive.
What's crazy is Ance is always like, "No, we can't stay in the house. We couldn't impose ourselves on you like that, or like we can't take." He doesn't get in an argument. Oh, not an argument, but like they're like, "Come in and have dinner," and he's like, "No, we just let us use your barn." And he's like, "My wife will be upset if you refuse her food. Come in." And it's just so funny that Ance is like not okay with taking a meal from people, yet he's dragging a corpse all across the town. It's like he's got an odd barometer of what's okay to impose on somebody.
And they all sort of do, because I mean, like now that you mentioned that, actually, I do want to go back to the scene that you described where Cash is building the coffin for Addie. Keep in mind, I don't know how much, I forgot how much detail you talked about it, but Addie is on her deathbed, about to die, and she's watching, like, there's a little window outside of her house, and she's watching Cash, like, build her coffin. So,
I know.
Already, from the start of the novel, we get the sense that they don't have the best judgment.
Yep, I totally agree with all of that. I mean, they're flawed. They're dysfunctional, for sure. Moving on to Dewey Dell and Vardaman. Okay, yeah, so Dewey Dell is the daughter in the book, right? And she as a character, I don't know, she's a little bit hard to root for. On the one hand, we can sympathize with her because she's gotten pregnant. There's a boy in the town named Leif, and the scene is really interesting. They kind of, she's like, well, you know, we'll sleep together if you can fill up the bag full of corn. But then, so she kind of is like taking it out of her hands. But then we do get the sense that she sort of rigs the game, right? Because she actually does want to sleep with him as well. She ends up getting pregnant. He is, I would say, less than ideal in terms of taking accountability or responsibility for that. He leaves her in a pretty uncomfortable position, and it's pretty clear that she's going to be kind of raising the child on her own. So she, like you said earlier, really is on board with this trip to take Addie to Jefferson because she thinks that she can get an abortion or abortion medication for her pregnancy. So on the one hand, I think a lot of people can sort of sympathize with her. Young girl, pregnant, left on her own, scared. The only other woman in the family is dead now. The woman that she did have was not very kind to begin with. So we can sympathize with her there. However, she doesn't really show any compassion for her mother. Like, at least with Jewel, his actions, or Darryl, however you view them, like if you think that the burning the barn was good or bad, they're both doing something for their mother that they think is right. Dewey Dell seems to have almost no regard for her mother. She shows some compassion for her little brother, Vardaman, but again, she's very opportunistic, and she's the one who, like we read earlier, sacrifices Darryl, which to me at least makes her seem kind of villainous. But again, she's complex because she goes to get the abortion medication and she is taken advantage of by the store worker. So he basically says, like, hey, if you exchange some sexual favors, I'll give you the medication. And he doesn't really give her the medication. So she sort of fluctuates between being a sympathetic character and kind of cold, I would say. Cold-hearted. Yeah, she's interesting as sort of like the lineage to her mother. Like, her mother is very cold and not very kind and warm, and she is not very kind and warm either, which to me, I'm just thinking about it now, is an interesting portrayal of women, right? Because when you think about the stereotypes, you're like, oh, doting mother, you know, emotional, sensitive, all these things that are kind of like positive negatives that were cast upon women. Faulkner's written two female characters that don't really fit that mold. And when you think about her, a theme that comes to my mind is like individualism versus collectivism. Like, the family has a collective goal of getting their mother to Jefferson, but she has an individual goal of getting an abortion. And to her, the individual very much supersedes the collective.
Yeah, she's really just along for the ride. I think she definitely has her own agenda.
Do you feel bad for her? Do you dislike her? What is your sort of emotional read on her?
It's easy to kind of overlook her as a character in general. I mean, she does have some really important plot points. One of the things that makes me more sympathetic towards her is actually one of the chapters that Addie, well, the only chapter that Addie talks in, when she sort of describes Dewey Dell as being her, I think she calls it like her unsin. Like, so she committed the sin of extramarital affair, and that led to Jewel. So then to make it right, she had sex with Anse again, and then, you know, produce Dewey Dell. So that's not a great way to describe, like, your child, right? Like, oh, I had you to make up for this bad thing that I did. She's sort of like the homemaker as well. Like, that's how I've kind of read her character. She's sort of used a lot. She's the one that's always milking the cows. She's putting food together. You know, she's sort of doing everything that Anse should be helping with. And I think Anse definitely takes advantage of his daughter more than, not in sexual ways, obviously, but just in labor.
There have been people that have posited or suggested that I don't know enough really to speak too much on this, but that Darryl has kind of a incestuous relationship with Dewey Dell. I don't know.
I didn't really read it that way.
I didn't either.
I can kind of see, like, there's some parts that I could kind of see. I think there's one, whenever Darryl had the premonition that Dewey Dell was pregnant, he said something along the lines of like it's too bad or something like that. I think some people read into it like, oh, it's like too bad because, like, you know, like I could have had her or something. But I didn't read that at all. I think it's just kind of like I don't know. Yeah, I don't see it at all. It seems more like fodder than anything else.
But I am wondering, like, how are we as 21st century readers looking at Dewey Dell compared to people back when the book was published, right? I think we have a very different view of women's rights and abortion, and I bet she was read differently back then than she is now.
Yeah, certainly, yeah. And she, you know, just as a matter of fact as well, she's also going to be the person likely taking care of Vardaman now that Addie is gone. Yep. So.
Moving on to Vardaman, I'd say we should definitely spend the least amount of time on him just because, I don't know, he doesn't move the plot along in the same way that the others do. He's a young child who's processing the loss of his mother. Addie dies right as he catches a fish, and because they happen simultaneously, he associates them. So he'll often say over and over the iconic line, "Is my mother is a fish." He connects those two deaths, and he spends some time in the novel thinking that he can get his mother back. Like, oh, she can't breathe in that coffin, so he drills the holes through, and he really drills through her face. I think, to me, he just adds a little bit of a degree to sadness to the novel, because it's a young kid who's lost his mother, who is, when we think about that theme of methods of coping with grief and death, he has an entirely different method of coping with grief and death than Jewel, Darryl, or Cash, just by virtue of his age.
Yeah, and he's also like just the most simple character. Everything that he observes, he directly tells you. He doesn't really put any sort of spin on it or anything. So I do see him a little bit more favorably than Dewey Dell, just because you're able to see him, you know that he's going to give you, like, he's going to give it to you as it is, right? He's not going to try to fool you, because he can't. He doesn't have the faculty to do that yet. So
he's like Cash in the sense that he's neutral, but he's not as good of a narrator because he's unreliable because of his age. So, like, he couldn't narrate the scene when Darryl gets taken away because we couldn't trust it. Not from a character who's been saying his mother's a fish for the last 100 pages. So I think that the main question we want to talk about, maybe for like 20-ish minutes or something, is have we as a society, a public, a world, moved past Faulkner? One of the most common complaints about Faulkner is that he's dated, the work is too difficult, he's inaccessible to young readers, and there's a podcast that I really like called The History of Literature, and they did an episode where they talk about, like, things that you don't need to read. And the host, Jack Wilson, who I also really like, said that he felt like Faulkner could pretty much be cut out. What do you think?
I would disagree with this statement. I think the sentiment that I hear most often is that people read this book a little bit too early. Maybe not just a little bit, like very early. Some people read this book in like high school. I didn't read this book in high school. I read this after I was already done with college and after I already was a little bit more well-equipped to handle a book like this on my own. But people that read this in high school probably maybe just aren't getting the best experience. Maybe they just didn't have the best teacher. I don't really know what the consensus is, but I think that since most people kind of view this book negatively if they read it early in high school, I think that there's an underlying cause. So I think that maybe if you have like a good teacher teach you this book, I think that you can do well. I think in general, it is important to keep this book in the back of our mind because it's inspired some of our favorite literature as well. Like, we might not have somebody like Cormac McCarthy without somebody like Faulkner inspiring him.
I think the influence is too deep, like you said. I mean, you can't. There's a reason why your favorite writer has read Faulkner, you know? So, like, Cormac McCarthy was a lot of people's favorite writer. Toni Morrison, they have very much grappled with him, and there's a reason for that. I think that one of the things that's going to keep it alive is the beauty of the language. That might seem a little bit like whimsical, like, oh, there's not that many people that care about language. But I've recently become, when Cormac McCarthy passed away last summer, I was on Twitter or X now, like scrolling, looking for things, blah, blah, blah. And it sort of changed the algorithms on my account to where then I got introduced to a lot of like what I would call book Twitter, like professors and just people who are really passionate about reading. And it really did show me that there's still a group of people that are very much concerned about aesthetics and the beauty of language. And even though I don't think reading occupies the space in society that it once did, I think that too much digital media has watered that down. There's still a group of people that value reading, value literature, and value the language. And for him, he's always going to be there for those people. So I think that in that sense, he's gonna be around.
Do you think this would be a book that you would be comfortable teaching like your AP Lit class or something like that if the opportunity ever presented itself?
Yeah, I would. I would. For sure. Definitely. I mean, I've taught Beloved before, and this to me is right up there with Beloved. I think maybe Beloved would resonate a little bit better just because of some of the social justice concerns. But I think there are really good debates to be had about, you know, like death, and should someone who's dead's wishes be honored, and what does it mean to be a family? So yeah, I would love to teach this book someday, and I think that if done well, it could be really powerful.
I think as the listeners know, like, I'm not a teacher, so like I wouldn't teach this book if I was a teacher. But I think if I was like teaching like a history course on like American Reconstruction, I would probably pull sections of this book to talk about like some of those things. So I think there's value outside of just literature as well. And I think that for that reason, you really just can't like remove it from the classroom.
I mean, he's concerned with themes of slavery and the fall of the South and the nuclear family, and these are still pertinent today. So yeah.
Abortion
for well. Sure, for sure. The other thing that really stands out to me, and this might be a little more of a stretch, is I think that the vignette style format with multiple perspectives it's one that I love. When I write my own stuff, I bounce around from character to character. And I think one of the reasons why it might work really well today is it sort of appeals to the social condition we're living in. Like, if you think about something like social media is really about a plurality of experience, right? I'm looking at what you're up to. I'm looking at what my other friend's up to, or my coworker's up to, and some random person, I have no idea what they're up to. We as a society, I think our brains are getting wired to shift from perspective to perspective to perspective to perspective. So I actually think that this style of writing might work well for a modern young reader, because you're never with a character too long. Just like when you're on Instagram, you're never with a person too long. So, like, if you looked at a book like Jane Eyre, where you're, like, kind of with her the whole time, that, to me, seems more likely to test a modern reader's patience than, like, oh, I'm with Darl now, and I'm with Jewel now, and I'm back with Darl, and I'm with Carol, Cora, and Tull, and Vardaman, and Dewey Dell. And I like that sort of skipping around, and I think that it taps into a modern consciousness. I think he's a model for contemporary readers and writers.
I think that's a good point, because I mean, like you said, you know, if something happens like that's newsworthy, you'll see it on social media and you'll hear all the different perspectives about it, and you know, kind of have these things to make your own mind on based on what you're seeing. But similar in this book, you know, things happen. This woman's getting paraded through the town. Different characters have different opinions about it, and you know, I think that is a good point. I think that does kind of coincide with the way that our brains are wired nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something that I want to experiment with in my own writing, and I think that the future of fiction is kind of might move in that direction. So you have a quote in here, criticism, and I had known this before. Nabokov was not a Faulkner fan. He calls him Corncobby Chronicles and basically poo-poos the idea that it's a masterpiece. I think Nabokov's obviously a great critic. I think he's a great reader. He's very well read. He's probably better read than I'll ever be. But he's too prickly about influence and influences. He's kind of arrogant in terms of, you know, he likes Anna Karenina and things like that.
Yeah, well, he's Russian, right? So I think he has his
favorites. He's kind of got a highfalutin sort of writer that he likes. So I think that a poor Southern family probably is not resonating with him in the same way that Anna Karenina or Dostoevsky is. Also, though, if you look at Nabokov's style, heavy on alliteration, very much about sound, there's no way he didn't pick some of that up from Faulkner. So to me, it's almost a little bit of Harold Bloom's anxiety of influence, like the people that have influenced you the most make you anxious a little bit, and you try to distance yourself from the people that you know have had a profound impact on you because, you know, you felt like you've been sort of usurped by them. I see a little bit of that there. So I like Nabokov. I think Pale Fire is great. I think Lolita is very interesting and strong in a lot of ways. We're gonna have to talk about that at some point.
Yeah, I agree.
But to me, I mean, if gun to my head, you can only keep Faulkner, you can only keep Nabokov, it's not going to be a tough decision for me.
I would agree with that. The only reason I kind of put this quote in here is that I really just wanted to get your thoughts on it, your raw thoughts on it, because I know it's probably going to be controversial to you for sure. I kind of chalked this up to a little bit of, like you said, there's a little bit of elitism almost when you read Nabokov. I think he was born in St. Petersburg, so he's from the city in Russia, right? So a little bit different. It's like, it's a, you know, comparing like an author that's born in New York versus one that's born in Mississippi, you know, you'll kind of have like your own literary circles that are comparing things like style, aesthetics, you know, the little nuances in writing. And really, I just sort of took this as maybe a regional disagreement at best.
Yeah, for sure. Do you think that I like Faulkner more than you do?
No, yeah, you do, but it's because you've probably read more Faulkner. I think you read it in college too, right? Like in some of your classes, right?
Yeah, I read it. Well, no, I didn't read it in college. Actually, I read it in high school, and then I've read As I Lay Dying a couple times, and then I've read Sound and the Fury, and I've read Light in August. This is the only Faulkner, right?
Yeah, so this is my first experience with Faulkner, right? Outside of the influences that he's had. I could see myself definitely growing onto this onto the Faulkner train, but it's
Would you read another one?
Oh yeah, like, no, absolutely.
If you had to pick up another one, what would it be? Do you have any idea?
People say a lot of things about Absalom. I feel like that's going to be the next one.
That's one that I have not read. I've read parts of it, so yeah, maybe that's a summer thing.
There's people whose opinions I respect that say a lot about Absalom. That makes me want to read it.
A lot of critics think that that's his masterwork. Sound and the Fury is also excellent. When I read Sound and the Fury, I was like pretty high on the train that it was like the third best thing I'd ever read. We should just maybe skim through some of the other strengths of the book. It's often called a tour de force. That's a phrase that gets attached to it a lot. We talked a lot about the language. I think that's part of the reason. I think the language is just really beautiful. Do you want to just go ahead and share a passage?
Okay, so the chapter that I'm going to be reading from is from Addie's chapter. This is her only chapter, and I think it's probably one of the most impactful chapters in the book. It is a fairly bit long, so I'll probably read some in the beginning, and then I'll let you know when I skip to it. But, you know, I just want to get the listeners a sense that Addie does have really strong feelings of remorse for Anse, her husband, so... And just to give a little background into what's going on in the chapter right before the paragraph that I'm going to start reading, Addie is basically describing how she hates her job and she's a school teacher and hates the kids that she works with. So essentially she's kind of swept off her feet by Anse. And so this is that part.
And so I took Anse. I saw him pass the schoolhouse 3 or 4 times before I learned that he was driving 4 miles out of his way to do it. I noticed then how he was beginning to hump. A tall man and young, so that he looked already like a tall bird hunched in the cold weather on the wagon seat. He would pass the schoolhouse, the wagon creaking slow, his head turning slow to watch the door of the schoolhouse as the wagon passed, until he went on around the curve and out of sight. One day I went to the door and stood there when he passed. When he saw me again, he looked quickly away and did not look back again. In the early spring it was worst. Sometimes I thought that I could not bear it, lying in bed at night with the wild geese going north and their honking coming faint and high and wild out of the wild darkness. And during the day it would seem as though I couldn't wait for the last one to go so I can go down to the spring. And so when I looked up that day and saw Anne standing there in his Sunday clothes, turning his hat round and round in his hands, I said, "If you've got any women folk, why in the world don't they make you get a haircut?"
"I ain't got none," he said.
Then he said suddenly, driving his eyes at me like 2 hounds in a strange yard,
"That's what I come to see you about."
"And make you hold your shoulders up," I said. "You haven't got any, but you've got a house. They tell me you've got a house and a good farm. And you live there alone, doing for yourself, do you?" He just looked at me, turning the hat in his hands. "A new house," I said. "Are you going to get married?" And he said again, holding his eyes to mine,
"That's what I come to see you about."
All right, I'm going to go ahead and skip just a little bit and go on to the next paragraph.
So I took Anse, and when I knew that I had cash, I knew that living was terrible and that this was the answer to it. That was when I learned that words are no good, that words don't ever fit even what they are trying to say at. When he was born, I knew that motherhood was invented by someone who had to have a word for it because the ones that had the children didn't care whether there was a word for it or not. I knew that fear was invented by someone that had never had the fear. Pride, who had never had the pride. I knew that it had been, not that they had dirty noses, but that we had had to use one another by words like spiders dangling by the mouths from a beam, swinging and twisting and never touching. And that only through the blows of the switch could my blood and their blood flow as one stream. I knew that it had been, not that my aloneness had to be violated over and over each day, but that it had never been violated until cash came, not even by ants in the nights.
Okay, I'm going to skip a little bit to the next paragraph when she finds out that she had Darryl.
Then I found out that I had Darryl. At first, I would not believe it. Then I believed that I would kill ants. It was as though he had tricked me, hidden within a word like within a paper screen, and struck me in the back through it. But then I realized that I had been tricked by words older than ants or love, and that the same word had tricked ants too, and that my revenge would be that he would never know I was taking revenge. And when Darryl was born, I asked ants to promise to take me back to Jefferson when I died, because I knew that Father had been right. Even when he couldn't have known that he was right, any more than I could have known I was wrong.
Nonsense, Ant said. You and me ain't nigh done chapping yet with just two.
He did not know that he was dead, then. Sometimes I would lie by him in the dark, hearing the land that was now of my blood and flesh, and I would think, ants? Why are you ants?
I would think about his name until after a while I could see the word as a shape, a vessel, and I would watch him liquefy and flow into it like cold molasses flowing out of the darkness into the vessel until the jar stood full and motionless, a significant shape profoundly without life like an empty doorframe, and then I would find that I had forgotten the name of the jar. I would think, the shape of my body where I used to be a virgin is in the shape of a blank, and I couldn't think ants. Couldn't remember ants. It was not that I could not think of myself as no longer unvirgin, because I was three now, and when I would think Cash and Darryl that way until their names would die and solidify into a shape and then fade away, I would say, all right.
All right, I'm going to skip just a couple more paragraphs here and go towards the end when I guess there's a final revelation.
My father said that the reason for living is getting ready to stay dead. I knew at last what he meant, and that he could not have known himself what he meant, because a man cannot know anything about cleaning up a house afterward. And so I have cleaned my house. With Jewel, I lay by the lamp, holding up my own head, watching him cap and suture it before he breathed. The wild blood boiled away, and the sound of it ceased. Then there was only the milk, warm and calm, and I laying calm in the slow silence, getting ready to clean my house. I gave Ants Dewey Dell to negative Jewel. Then I gave him Vardaman to replace the child that I had robbed of him. And now he has three children that are his and not mine. And then I can get ready to die. One day I was talking to Cora. She prayed for me because she believed I was blind to sin, wanting me to kneel and pray too. Because people to whom sin is just a matter of words, to them, salvation is just words too.
All right, so the reason that I chose that chapter is because I felt that the listeners should really understand how much remorse Addie has in her life for her husband, and not only for her husband, but also for having children, and she only considers Jewel her child, and the rest of them can pretty much go kick rocks, essentially, is what she's saying. Now, Troy will be reading from his passage.
Okay, so this is Darryl's section, and like I talked about before, I think Darryl is really a surrogate for Faulkner. You get the most beautiful prose in Darryl, in my opinion, and this is his description of the river. It says, "Before us the thick dark current runs. It talks up to us in a murmur, becomes ceaseless and myriad. The yellow surface dimpled monstrously into fading swirls, traveling along the surface for an instant, silent, impermanent, and profoundly significant, as though just below the surface, something huge and alive waked for a moment of lazy alertness out of and into light slumber again. It clucks and murmurs among the spokes and about the mule's knees, yellow, skewed with flotsam, and thick with soiled gouts of foam, as though it had sweat lathering, like a driven horse. Through the undergrowth it goes with a plaintive sound, a musing sound. In it the unwinded cane and saplings lean as before a little gale, swaying without reflections, as though suspended on invisible wires from the branches overhead. Above the ceaseless surface they stand, trees, cane, vines, rootless, severed from the earth, spectral, above a scene of immense yet circumscribed desolation filled with the voice of the waste and mournful water. Cash and I sit in the wagon. Jules sits the horse at the off-rear wheel. The horse is trembling, its eyes rolling wild and baby blue in its long pink face, its breathing stertorous like groaning. It sits erect, poised, looking quietly and steadily and quickly this way and that, his face calm, a little pale and alert. Cash's face is also gravely composed. He and I look at one another with long probing looks, looks that plunge unimpeded through one another's eyes and into the ultimate secret place, where for an instant Cash and Darl crouch flagrant and unabashed in all the old terror and the old foreboding, alert and secret and without shame. When we speak, our voices are quiet, detached. I love that, the description of nature, the use of vocabulary, the philosophical thoughts about the two brothers being connected in their minds. So, yeah, that's an example of what Faulkner can do at his best. I think that another strength of this book is its compactness. There are so many voices in major events. You've got floods, you've got fires, you've got deaths, you've got sexual relations, you've got all kinds of things happening in a very short amount of space. And I think that it's, you know, Faulkner claims he knew exactly where he was going to go, and he almost knew exactly where the last period would fall. He says, "I set out deliberately to write a tour de force before I ever put pen to paper and set down the first word. I knew what the last word would be and almost where the last period would fall." I think that's a little bit of exaggeration. I think he was mythologizing himself a little bit. However, I do think that he had a pretty clear understanding of each of the family members, and it creates this sort of imaginative power. Like, I don't think he wrote two-thirds of the book and he thought to himself, you know what this needs? A daughter. I'm going to go back and rewrite in Dewey Dell. Like, I think he had all of them sort of in his head from the beginning. And so there's a cleanness and a crispness to it that stands out. It doesn't ramble on.
But it's interesting, too, that you mentioned the compactness. Because one of the qualities I found really strong in the book is just how each character, I mean, we've already talked about Darl having, you know, a different voice compared to the other characters. Even though some of the other characters are limited in their language, they tend to use the same words, but they don't sound the same.
Yeah, you really honestly wouldn't need the names after a little while, at least with most of them. I mean, Vardaman would be very obvious. Darl would be very obvious. Cash would be obvious. I think so, too. Do we want to spend just a couple minutes talking about tragedy and comedy? I got to tell you, a lot of people say this book is comic. I see it. I don't see it as much as other people see it. So to me, it's very much a tragedy. Addie's life is a tragedy. She lives a jaded life in which she believes in very little. She says at one point that the purpose of living, I think her father tells her that the purpose of living is to get ready to die, which would make for quite a tattoo. Addie's death is a tragedy because it brings hardship to everyone but aunts. Dewey Dell fails in her pursuit to get an abortion. Darl is taken away from his family and feels betrayed by the brother he cares about the most. Young boy Vardaman loses his mother. Jewel loses his horse, which is like his prized possession. Cash loses some functionality of his body and his leg. So to me, it's very sad. There's some comedy in there when the overweight, obese doctor's getting dragged up the hill. That was kind of funny to me. It's like, you know, Ants' thing with his teeth is a little bit funny. But yeah, do you want to speak to the comedy-tragedy balance? Because I'm seeing tragedy. I'm seeing 90% tragedy, 10% comedy.
Yeah, there is one thing I do want to push back on, though, is when you said Addie's death is a tragedy and brings hardship to everybody but Anne's. I think you're right, but I think that it does bring a sort of hardship to Anne's, too, because now he's even more useless, right? Like, now he can't get somebody to do something for him. Like, now he's...
Do you think he'll just get Dewey Dell to do it, though?
Exactly, yeah. That's what I mean. Like, now he has to sort of think a little bit more outside the box, even though it's really not that different of a concept. Like, I do think that it does bring a certain hardship to him. I mean, who's gonna take care of his manly needs? You know, it's stuff like that. If you think, he has to go out and find a wife now. So that's another part. Okay, so
he's back on the dating scene for a quick second.
Man. So as useless as Ed's is, he's really good at one, he's good at talking, and he's good at finding women, apparently. So
yeah.
This is where the comedy portion of the book shines, because on the one hand, it's ridiculous, and on the other hand, it's tragic. So I wholeheartedly agree with Troy that the book is more on the side of tragic. However, with that being said, the comedy portion is also pretty funny just due to how ridiculous it is. Essentially, what happens is, as we talked about before, Dewey Dell gets impregnated by one of the city boys. His name is Leif. Leif essentially gives Dewey Dell a bit of money. He gives her $10 and says, hey, take this money and get an abortion, basically. I don't know if the technology or the medicine or whatever the procedure is, I don't know if it was, like, available at that time. And so, like, in my mind, I kind of read this as Leif basically saying, like, hey, here's $10. Do with this what you will. I'm not going to have any involvement with our child if you decide to have it. Take care of yourself, essentially, is how I read it. I could be wrong, but that's what I thought of it. So he gives her this money. Dewey Dell, you know, this is a lot of money for them. So they might make a couple dollars here and there every week due to the various odd jobs that the boys take on, but they're not going to make $10 at once. You know, it's pretty uncommon for them. So she has this money, and she's holding it tight because she needs the money to go get an abortion in the town. And essentially, Ants finds out, well, for starters, like we already talked about before, Dewey Dell gets taken advantage of by one of the clinic hands, and she doesn't give up any of the money, but essentially trades sexual favors for what she thinks is going to be abortion medication. And then what happens after is Ants finds out that Dewey Dell had this money, and he basically strong arms her into giving him the money. You know, he guilt trips her hard. He's like, you know, I've given you everything that I've had ever since you were born. You know, I don't know why you would withhold this money from me. And Dewey Dell is like trying to kind of reason with him, like, hey, this isn't my money. I promise you, if it was my money, I would have already given it to you. So she's trying to stop him from taking the money, but it doesn't work. Ants takes the money anyway. One of the big insecurities that Ants has is that he can't eat because he doesn't have any teeth, or he has very few teeth, one of the two. And many of the portions of his chapter are dedicated to him talking about how much he wants to eat, how life is meaningless without food, which I agree with. You know, I think it would suck if you didn't have any teeth and couldn't enjoy food. Obviously, you know, it's human nature to enjoy food, I think. So yeah, that's one of his biggest insecurities. So the next day after taking Dewey Dell's money, Ants goes out and buys a new set of teeth. And not only does he buy a new set of teeth, Ants is happily married now. Ants, after just having buried his wife, is now married. And funny enough, the person who he marries is the person who lends him a shovel to bury his wife. So they don't have a shovel to bury Addie. And so with the first house of the encounter in the town, Ants goes up to them and basically is like, hey, I need to borrow a shovel to bury my wife. And listen, I don't know what kind of game this guy's spitting. I don't know what kind of riz he has. Well, we do know because it works, right? So he has a new wife and a new set of teeth at the expense of Dewey Dell and probably the other members of the family.
I know. And the final line, I just want to make sure I get it exactly right. Meet Mrs. Bundren, he says, which is like they've just traveled through water and flood and fire to get their mother buried, and now he's got the new one lined up, the new Mrs. Bundren. She's not even named. She's the replacement. Yeah, he is a funny – I mean, he does have some funny characteristics for sure, and he adds a little bit of a levity to the book. one of the questions that we just talked about was whether or not we've kind of moved past Faulkner. And both of us agreed that we don't think that we have moved past Faulkner, partially because he has influenced other writers, right? This is the Shakespeare argument. Yes, you do not have to have read a single thing Shakespeare's written to have been influenced by Shakespeare, because his influence has been refracted through all the people that you have read and watched and seen and listened to. I think it's a little bit like that with Faulkner. So my favorite writer I've mentioned before, I'll mention again many times, is Cormac McCarthy. There are obvious comparisons between Cormac McCarthy and William Faulkner. I do think that the comparisons are overstated a little bit. I think that the better you know McCarthy, the more you see that they're different. But I do think that McCarthy looked at Faulkner, and Faulkner gave him a kind of a literary permission to experiment with language and to experiment with elements of the grotesque. So McCarthy has a very rich, verbose, flamboyant, hyper-linguistic style of writing, and I think that Faulkner has that too. I think they employ it in different ways, but I think McCarthy looked at Faulkner and said, hey, this is somebody who's doing the kind of thing that I'm feeling in my heart that I would like to do, and so he gave him permission to do that. A difference is, I think that Faulkner is much more concerned with character development than McCarthy. One of the things about McCarthy is he very rarely gives you sort of a character's internal psychology. You have to make inferences, or it's indirect characterization through action and word. The kid, I think, is a great example in Blood Meridian. Faulkner loves the psychology of his characters. I mean, we're very much in Darl's head. We are in Cash's head. We're in Dewey Dell's head. She's narrating her own past and her own feelings about getting pregnant. So I think that that is a difference between the two, but clearly influenced. Talking quickly about the grotesque, I mean, Faulkner has the short story A Rose for Emily, which is definitely grotesque. There's parts of the grotesque in this book with the rotting corpse and drilling holes through her. And I think that you see somebody like McCarthy take that to a whole new level with something like Child of God, for example, with the necrophilia in that book. Do you want to talk a little bit about James Newlick?
Yeah, so one of the books that we discussed earlier, and also we have an episode on, those are first episode of this podcast, is The Moon Down to Earth by James Newlick. James Newlick is a much more modern author just by virtue of the fact that he came after Faulkner, but this is one of the authors that I think you can see a clear influence from Faulkner on. And one of the clearest examples of this is just in the writing style in general. So we already talked about the shifting points of view of each of the novel of Azalea Dying, and I think you can see the same sort of influence on The Moon Down to Earth, because while it doesn't have as many characters as Azalea Dying, Moon Down to Earth does have a lot of shifting points of view chapter by chapter, just in the same way as Azalea Dying does. And some of the ways that I think they differ is that, well, Azalea Dying is a sort of a typical journey story, and I think it has a much more linear narrative, whereas The Moon Down to Earth has a less linear storytelling. I think it's probably done for character development. I mean, there is a clear ending of the book, but there's not a clear beginning or a middle of the novel. So that's one of the places where I think that this point does differ. I've actually heard somebody else mention that The Moon Down to Earth is sort of like a body narrative and what happens to our bodies as we age. And this is essentially the same thing. So, I think it was Leaf by Leaf who said that.
It was mistaken. Chris.
Yeah,
Thea.
He called it a body narrative. It's the way that that the body, you know, decays, and you can see that here. So some of the imagery that we see with Addie in As I Lay Dying, you know, being paraded through the town, essentially decaying, is similar to the body image that you see in The Moon Down to Earth. Elizabeth's mother is in the other room, rotting away. Elizabeth is confined to her bed, so she can't, she can get rid of the body. She can call somebody, but she chooses not to. So why they want to hold on to a dead body is for you to decide, right? Like, you as the reader will just get the individual perspectives, but for whatever reason that they choose to have this go on, it's up to you to decide. So I think that's where the some of the influence comes as well. They die in different ways. Addie seems to die of more natural causes, and we're not entirely sure what the cause of death is with her, but with Elizabeth's mother, it sounds like she has a heart attack or something, but either way, both Addie and Elizabeth's mother, both pretty bad mothers and both sort of resentful of the father figure, or lack of father thereof, and in each scenario. So those are some of the areas where I see the strong resemblance of the writing.
Yeah, I think those are great. Those are great connections in terms of the narrators and just preoccupations, like with the body. Speaking of preoccupations, I think a major influence is Toni Morrison. She, if I'm not mistaken, has sort of downplayed the influence of Faulkner. But again, if I'm not mistaken, I think that she wrote her dissertation on Faulkner. So there's no way that he was not a major influence on her. And I think that a lot of the writing that she does is kind of a response to him. So I think that maybe she is not all the way thrilled with his portrayal of race relations in the South. So her work is kind of a response to him. But even if it's the opposite, a response is still influence. You know, they have a very... They shift between the first and the third person during important parts. They're very concerned about what it means to be a family. Like if you think about the dynamic between Setha, Denver, Paul D, and Beloved, and then this family dynamic, it's like both are trying to explore the downsides or the difficulties of family. So she's somebody that I think was also very influenced by him. The one that I think is probably least known, just because he's not quite as known, he's probably a little more known than Nulick, I don't know, but not as much as Morrison or McCarthy, is Justin Torres, the author of We the Animals, just recently won, I think it might have been the Pulitzer or the National Book Award. But anyway, his debut novel was We the Animals, which I love. It was also comprised of vignettes, and it tells the story of these three brothers and their family, and gradually one of the brothers, Manny, starts to get kind of distanced from the others, and it seems to be because he's gay or is LGBTQ+, or he's... Final scene there is his family taking him to, like, an insane asylum, pretty much. And the scene in the front yard, it's been a long time since I've read it, I would want to go look at it again, but the scene in the front yard to me seems very reminiscent of Darrow getting taken away. And from that point on, it's no longer we, which is how the story's been told before. He's separated off, and he's distanced from his family. And so that shift in point of view reminds me a little bit of the shift we get where Darrow is kind of like hovering over himself, looking at his body. So I don't know. To me, it seems like there's just no way. If I had to bet my life one way or the other, I would feel relatively confident that Justin Torres has read As I Lay Dying, and that scene, whether he admits it or not, kind of burrowed its way into his brain, because it almost seems like he's rewriting it.
I think, like you said earlier, you don't have to read Shakespeare to have read him, because of the influence that he's had on much of literature afterwards. And I think the same could be said of Faulkner for a lot of American fiction. A lot of American fiction just seems to be a footnote on Faulkner, and that's sort of like a play on the famous philosophical belief that all of modern philosophy is a footnote on Plato. So
there's a tree. It's a huge web and a tree of these authors who have been influenced by each other, and it's like sports in that way. Kind of like, oh, you know, Kobe picked up this from MJ, but he picked up some footwork from Hakeem Olajuwon, and you can get the similar things, like, you know, okay, McCarthy picked up some of his language from Faulkner, but then some of his themes are Shakespeare's, and then so I would love for Torres to talk about Faulkner, because there's too many parallels.
I agree with the same thing, but with Nulick, there's too many comparisons, like you said. It can't be coincidental, right?
He has to have read it. And usually great writers, or, you know, noteworthy writers like Nulick and Torres, usually if you're a great writer, you're really well read. And we're talking about a book that is part of the canon. This isn't some strange book that we found somewhere in some used bookstore. Like, oh, I bet he's read it too, and there's only 10 copies in the world. Like,
right.
I think they obviously know Faulkner. And if you know Faulkner, you've probably read Faulkner, and this would be the one. Do you want to talk a little bit about our next book since it's close to your heart?
All right, so the next book that we're going to be covering is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Hunter S. Thompson. I'm very excited to talk about this book. I think it is one of the, I think it's a phenomenal book. I mean, there's a 10 out of 10 stars for me. I love it. Troy, on the other hand, I hope he loves it. Troy is not a big fan of the journalism style books. Like, you know, I try to get him to read In Cold Blood, which is one of my favorite books by Truman Capote. He hated it. I don't know why. He just he's not a fan of the journalism style books. But this is one of those great books that is really easy to read. It's really easy to get into. And similar to My Brilliant Friend, it kind of meets you at your level, meets you where you are. So if you're more interested in the literature, you can be interested in it. I think he employs great language. If you're interested in the socio-historical aspect of it, go ahead and research about it. You know, it meets you where you are, just like My Brilliant Friend. So I think it's a great novel. And actually, Hunter S. Thompson is somebody that's widely regarded in journalism. He's inspired many journalists. And, you know, they carry one of his books called Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail. A lot of journalists that cover politics kind of use this as sort of like a guiding light to their work. So I think it's a great book. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is going to be a fun episode, I think. So I'm looking forward to it. This is also a book that I recommend to people that are in a reading slump and want to read more, just because I think it's so funny and just so easy to read.
Cormac McCarthy called it a classic of our time and one of the few great modern novels. So, and I mean, you know how I feel about him. So I'm interested. I'm excited to check it out. I think it'll be really good because Cormac McCarthy has said that there are only four great novels ever written: Sound and the Fury by Faulkner, Ulysses by James Joyce, Moby Dick by Herman Melville, which is number one to him, and Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. So the fact that he calls this a classic of our time is exciting to me. And I don't know, you could tell me more because you've read them both, but you know how I feel about Jesus' Son. It seems like there are some Jesus' Son vibes.
Yeah, I think there are. I think there's definitely parallels between the books with regards to drug use and just overall, like, the general message. Like, I never think that the book, either book, really looks to drugs favorably. I think that it's kind of like a cautionary tale of what happens when you use drugs, so those are the places where I see the most similarity, I think.
All right, well, I'm looking forward to it. We will catch you with Fear and Loathing next time on the Thousand Lives podcast.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider giving us a follow, or please share this podcast with your friends that are fellow book lovers. I think it would really help our channel a lot, so thank you.